I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Clint Watts is a West Point graduate, a former Army officer and counterterrorism agent for the FBI, and more recently has been tracking and engaging terrorists and trolls through social media. He was one of the first to sound the alarm about the Kremlin's efforts to disrupt the 2016 presidential election using disinformation and propaganda. He testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee that the U.S. is not just vulnerable to cyber attacks, but needs to take them more seriously and devise a plan to counter them. Clint Watts spends a lot of time online and writes in his new book, Messing with the Enemy, that the Internet has brought us together while social media is tearing us apart. The book is subtitled Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News, our topic for today's Radio Times. He's a Robert A. Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute's program on the Middle East, which is located here in Philadelphia. Also a senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. And Clint Watts, nice to have you with us in person on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Who's our enemy?
Us, largely.
We're us?
Yeah.
We have met the enemy and it's us?
Yeah, I call it the fourth or fifth generation enemy is really us in the sense that we're on social media platforms. We don't really understand what's happening with us and what we're doing to make our environment sort of shape around our preferences. And I think that's the big thing is we used to sort of just blame the internet for filter bubbles, which was how the algorithm is sending us information. But really this now in social media is about our preferences. We are constantly liking or retweeting or sharing or blocking out opposition to what we want. And this really, I don't think Americans understand when they're on social media, that's a world, an artificial world entirely created to suit them. And no one else sees the world the same way through their social media.
Because it's all tailor-made to our interests and our needs and who our friends are and the news we get, all of
exactly.
that.
Exactly. And we listen to only those sources or those pieces of information that we like. That's called implicit bias. That's our in-group informs us as opposed to an out-group, which we don't trust. And then confirmation bias, which we constantly feed to ourselves more of what confirms what we already want to believe. And you don't realize you're getting into it. It's a very slow process. It's the boiling the frog. You don't mm-hmm. know you're in your own bubble, but you slowly are the more you're on the applications.
You write the internet brought people together, but social media is tearing everyone apart. I mean, you really think we're being torn apart by our social media habits?
Yeah, I think that's the brilliance of the Russian disinformation system is they could kind of realize how they could use active measures, they used to say, how they would use the force of politics rather than the politics of force to divide up democratic electorates along race, religion, social economic status, whatever group, and then pit them against each other. And at the same point, elevate candidates that are supportive of their view amongst this chaos so that the U.S. can't really counter or rise up globally anymore because they're so rife with conflict internally. That social media application is perfect for that because you can scope out everyone's likes, preferences, what their little worlds look like, and aggregate them together. And by creating a false persona that looks like them and talks like them, mm-hmm. nudge them to move towards a position they may not normally just run to.
But are Russians any better at this than anyone else, or they're just more determined, more dogged?
They're better at the art of it, meaning they've always sort of thought this way. Their information warfare was really perfected on their own Russian citizens, you know, Russian people were the ones that were part of this. If you look at the end of the Cold War, when the Soviet Union fell, two big things happened, and one of them was the Russians learned or sort of knew from the oligarch and Kremlin level that the only thing worse than no information is too much information. If you just drown out the population with so many alternative scenarios, competing hypotheses, public relations efforts, you won't know what to believe, and you sort of back away or you just pick what you want. And they understood that. As social media came on board, they also recognized the power of it. And so I think when they saw the Arab Spring, for example, they see these uprisings, which are completely mobilized just using information. Right. They're like, we know how to use this information. We know how to do this information warfare. And look what this amazing tool, this social media applications can do. And I think they really thought of a way, how can we harness this? And they're brilliant at the art, but they won't really be who we should worry about as much in the future.
Well, I do want to get to that, which is, and you write this, it's not an information war, but a war on information itself. And I would say, as someone who has to do a show every day, I get confused. I mean, sometimes I have to go back to basics, like who is this person and how do right. they fit into this narrative? And am I saying something that's right or something that's wrong?
Right.
Is that the goal, to just confuse the hell out of us?
It's to make it impossible to distinguish between fact and fiction, or reporting versus opinion. So, you know, I think a common way to think about it from an authoritarian's view is it's just your public relations versus my public relations. There is no such thing as like true information, and we're just going to battle it out. And the strong narrative wins. And the more you can amplify it, the more you can push it, the more you can enlist people to your belief system, then that is the truth. That's alternative facts. That's sort of what we hear in our own political discussions, which is if I can overpower my adversary in the information space, I decide what the truth is and I decide what fact is. And that's very tough for democracies. It's very effective for authoritarians who want to suppress their own populations. But for democracies, it's a disaster. You can't have policy debate if you don't believe or there are true facts or you don't know what true facts are.
Because democracies are supposed to be open. I mean, open information, the ability to engage with people with access to information.
Right. The policy debate has to be centered on some bearing of truth. And that's why we depend so much on institutions. Do you believe what the institutions are putting out and what elected officials are saying? This is critical in our current time. If you don't, then you really can't debate about what the right way is to go. And it isn't so much that it stops debate. It just creates inaction, complete inaction, to where any policy debate, whether it's taxes or climate science or what should we do in terms of foreign policy or domestic issues like immigration, you just can't move forward because no one can even decide where to start from. It's almost just a paralysis that sets in the democratic debate.
So has Russia beaten us? I mean, in this cyber war? Did they defeat us?
Yeah, I don't know that they've entirely defeated us. They've definitely struck a blow at us with minimal effort, really. I mean, this is so small, you know, in terms of the effort and the amount of energy, but they have injected into the information space a way to go about fighting in information warfare that everyone is adopting. So I commonly get asked about 2018, you know, are you worried about the Russians? I'm like, no, I'm more worried about Americans who are just duplicating that methodology for their own political purposes.
And borrowing from the Russians? Or we were talking before going on the air about, you know, who's spreading whose misinformation.
Right. So the Russians, I always tell people now, don't need to make fake news. So the Kremlin's trolls, you know, their conspiracy outlets, there is plenty of false information and narratives spread around the American space that they can just latch on to, repurpose, and amplify. And the idea isn't so much – and that's even better. If you have the opportunity to take the target audience, in this case the U.S., their content, and just – grab it and spit it back into that space. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to go. You don't have to make it, so it's less cost. And you already know it's effective because it's coming from your audience.
Well, we know – I'm thinking of all the stories more recently. You mentioned immigration, that there are a number of people on the media who get a fair amount of attention who are saying that some of these migrant children or babies are fake.
Right. It's already set in very strongly in our country just in the last 2 years, is that you can't trust any information that's out there. And so you'll hear different audiences, depending on the scenario, say that audio, that video is all faked or photoshopped. It's not real. You can't trust that outlet. And this comes to, well, we have elected officials now that are at war with the media, essentially, and then creating their own media outlets. Mm. That's the other alternative, is bash the mainstream media that might check you, but then also create your own alternative media outlet to promote your cause. And this is not only happening in the United States. You're seeing it some in Canada. In their recent elections, they've had some of this. And it's most devastating in authoritarian regimes, particularly in the Southern Hemisphere. Southeast Asia, I think, is a great example of what happens when this gets out of control. Myanmar, Cambodia, Philippines have all had this authoritarian suppression techniques used through the information warfare space. How they use social media to sort of suppress alternative opinions they don't like and amplify what they do believe.
There was a new poll just came out, a Gallup Knight Foundation survey finding that, and I'm going to quote here, this is from where my Washington Post asked to estimate the percentage of news on TV, radio, newspapers that qualifies as, quote, misinformation. Republicans said 51%, Democrats said 23%, conservatives, liberals, basically the same number.
Right.
So you see this, whether it's true or not, the feeling that for half of the Republicans, they feel as if the news that they get is misinformation.
Yeah, I think that's probably very accurate. And this is, this is striking a blow back from the election, but continuing since then. The Russians have had way more success with their influence efforts because we continue to talk about it and amplify it and debate about it. And so I don't imagine when they started out to try and nudge on the election that they ever thought this is how it would sort of unfold. Like, it probably exceeded their wildest expectations for disrupting how we behave inside the United States.
Because we're amplifying this. I mean, even as we talk, are we amplifying it as we're having this conversation?
Yes, we're extending it. You know, we're I think the start of it for my colleagues, Jan Berger, Andrew Weisberg, and I was January, February, March, you know, of 2014. This is now 4 years on. And we just saw this week where more Russian troll accounts were shut down, you know, by Twitter. And they were tweeting about things as recent as Roseanne and the NFL and those sorts of things, all way post-election. And they also see things like the Mueller investigation. You could play both sides of that. Any Senate committee or House committee, you can play both sides of that and just create more tension in the debate. And so it's not the Russians doing so much as it's our doing. And most of the disinfo efforts I see that are more sophisticated today are not Russian. They're English speakers. Huh. You know,
they American are around, English speakers?
Yeah. I don't know who it is exactly, but the techniques that I see are mostly adapted by, I assume it's either political or social efforts that are trying to advance their cause.
And of course, the technology allows us to do that. We can, I mean, in the comfort of our own computer room, you know, put people's heads on different people's bodies, and you can, there are all sorts of technological ways that you can, in a sense, make disinformation.
Yeah, there's been a much, each stage of this, you know, when it goes to the internet, to basically YouTube was kind of with extremists. We saw them pop up there, and then moving to social media is that there's a lower barrier to entry, not just for entering into the information space, but in terms of creating content. If you can create content, you can completely go around the traditional media outlets and make your own media outlet. And if it confirms what people believe and it comes from, you know, friends and family rather than coming from your television,
right,
you can really build a strong audience that has an allegiance to you. Whether you actually know much of anything at all or have any data, you can create the narratives that you know the audience wants, and they will then in turn support and champion you.
Do you worry about our country?
Yes. I think it could go a couple different ways. You know, in recent months I've sort of described it as there's a bad scenario and there's a good scenario that I see from the last 2 years since the election time. The bad one is that depending on how the election goes in 2020, and if you see flip-flopping back and forth between parties, I would not be surprised if in 2024 or 2028 you see a major candidate run under the auspices of breaking up the United States of America. If you look at Texas,
breaking the country apart.
Yes. Texas exit, Cal exit, Alaska back to Russia. A lot of these state sort of based movements, which the Russians had a hand in at times, but many of them are organic, could gain traction. I don't think the candidate would win, you know, that would want to break up the U.S. But what if they got 5% of the support across the nation?
Hmm.
Just popular support of 5%. That would be a devastating blow to the United States, that one out of 20, you know, Americans might want to not be part of America anymore. And that is kind of the devolution process of the Russians. That's the bad scenario. I think the good
Hold on to the good one only because we have to take a very short break. That's Clint Watts, our guest. The book is Messing with the Enemy. Do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowain, and if you're just joining us, Clint Watts is our guest. He's a Robert A. Fox Fellow in the Foreign Policy Research Institute's program on the Middle East, and that is located here in Philadelphia. Also a senior fellow at the Center for Cyber and Homeland Security at George Washington University. And he's got a new book called Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. You can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times to join our conversation. All right, so we got the bad news, which is there could
right,
be a candidate. They might not win, but nonetheless, with the idea of splitting the country apart. So what's the good news?
I think the good news is the return to physical and in-person activism we've seen over the past couple of years, which has also been in parallel with massive social media connections. And so you could always look to the negative of it, but I think there's been a lot of positive. We've seen activism like we haven't seen this country in decades or maybe ever, you know, in terms of volume. And there has been participation grassroots on both sides of the political spectrum. So we could say, you know, maybe this is a period where we sort of had this setback in our country and we're going to come together, you know, pave over our differences. I think the jury is out on whether that will come true. You know, we have an election 2018. And ultimately, I think the deciding factor will be, do we move to a common ground to resolve problems post-elections? Usually in our country, our elected leaders try to win by being somewhat partisan and then post-election bring both sides together to move forward and advance the country. That hasn't happened in recent years. And they're not strongly incentivized to do that anymore due to gerrymandering,
sure,
a host of other issues.
Sure.
And so when we move forward, will they let their sort of social media nation subside enough that the physical nation can progress? And that's a big test.
Yeah. It's a big test for the country.
And the 18 and 20 elections will be the test of that because everyone is using this sort of social media partisanship to drive their audience, bring a base of support, donations, whatever it might be. But they'll actually have to cooperate with the other side if they're going to move forward and be successful, or for the country to be successful.
I do want to talk about a terrorist that you had an online, if I can say, relationship with, but got to know online. But let me just throw something more at you, something you said during the break, which is look at Arizona, that Arizona is kind of either a case study or a ground zero for what you're talking about.
Yeah, when I'm watching in the U.S. in terms of, I call them preference bubbles in the book, you're seeing the digital tail wag the physical dog, meaning that prophecy, like a fake news or a Pizzagate kind of thing, will pop up. And you actually see physical actions that occur on the ground then and mobilizations or migrations. So you see people that think alike and talk alike online start to say, well, maybe I'll move closer to people that are like me. So this is the virtual world leading the physical world. I think Arizona is a great test case of this. If you look at Senators McCain and Flake, which were mainstream Republicans, I mean, one ran for president and,
sure,
and could have won, is now been pushed out basically of his party and pushed aside. Both of those senators have to push for a more extreme part of that party. I think you see lots of physical actions that have occurred that are based on maybe false premises or manipulated truths in different ways. And there's heavy debate on the immigration issue. And so I think that is an example of how you can see this partitioning of the United States over time.
Do you see it on the left as well?
I see it on the left, but it's not so much based around physical. It's interesting, the left politically, they don't really organize so much around one or two news sources. It's more diverse and it's more issue-based. And so what I'm curious about is how do the issue basis of the Midwestern Democratic Party interface with the resistance of the Northeast, you know, or California or these places. They're very different. When I grew up in Missouri, so the Democratic Party of Missouri is wildly different to me than the Democratic Party of the Coast. And so they haven't had this sort of conflict yet, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't happen in the future.
Let me ask you about a guy named Omar Hamani.
Yes.
Hamami?
Yeah.
Hamani? Is that?
Yeah, Hamami.
Hamami. He was American-born.
Yes.
Ended up in Somalia, belonged to what became, I guess, al-Shabaab. You met him online.
Yes.
What was the nature of your contact with him? What did you want to know? What were you engaging him about?
Yeah, I originally started writing about Omar because he was one of the few American foreign fighters that had been recruited to an extremist organization that had grown in popularity online. And so he was known for being a jihadi rapper. He had put out a YouTube video. This is when you saw American culture sort of integrate with jihadi ideology in a very strange way. And so he gained some notoriety, and the terrorist group elevated him very quickly because he was drawing Americans and Westerners. But he had a falling out. He, typical of Americans, got too big for his britches. He thought he knew better than the boss, and the boss essentially didn't want any more of him. And so he was pushed out of his terrorist group and hunted. And during this, he would be on Twitter. He created a Twitter persona. He would actually write his autobiography. He would write up his plans for the future of jihad. He thought he'd be like a future bin Laden. And in those Twitter conversations, when I ran into him, because he was trying to raise awareness of his plight, and he wanted to talk to somebody who had been a former FBI agent, Army officer.
And you talk about establishing rapport.
Right. It's interesting. Back in those days, the idea in social media was two parts, really. One was, we'll save the world in social media by engaging with these people and making them feel loved, you know, that kind of the fairy tale. And then the other part was, let's just shout them down for being extremists. You know, this is a way to battle them online. And neither of those approaches ultimately have worked very well. I was more curious about, can we get his story out into the public? Because the more his story is in the public, the less chance somebody in America is going to want to go follow his path.
Because he was being hunted.
Right. He's being hunted by his own terrorist group. And that's typical, is you're more likely to be killed by your own terrorist group as a foreign fighter, I think, in many ways, than by the counter-terrorists that are chasing you around the world. And so I wanted that story illuminated. And by talking with him, I could really bring his story out into the public.
You asked him these kinds of questions. I'm sure there were many other ones. Yeah. Omar, question for you. Applebee's, TGI Fridays, or Chili's, you pick. Omar, lunch question, buffalo wings, nachos, or pizza, you pick. Tonight for dinner, Omar, what do you think? Chicken soft tacos, Caesar salad, or Chinese takeout, all halal, of course.
Right.
What are you doing there?
I was wanting him to engage in a couple different ways. One, I wanted him to show that he was an American, because he was trying to win a base of support with extremists in a way. And if he's talking to me, an American, like an American, this goes very much like disinformation, right? Then he's less inclined to be drawing much reception from his audience, which wants him to be a devout extremist. The other part of it was I wanted him to talk about how much he missed America or what his proclivities were. And the third part is I wanted people to realize that they're terrorists and counter-terrorists, about 80% think and talk about the same things, food, what daily life is like. They just choose different ideas to pursue ultimately. And that was always striking to me in the FBI or the military, when you're dealing with these kind of people at the foot soldier level, they all are kind of foot soldiers. And so oftentimes if you don't hear a different language, they actually are thinking about a lot of the same things.
But do they, I mean, using Omar as an example, is it they want to go kill people? They're true believers. They are lonely. I mean, do you understand the attraction, I guess, to especially to a group like Al-Shabaab or even ISIS,
right,
that these are killers?
Yeah, it's a mix, and it's a different combination for everybody. I think what people oftentimes hear in the news in the U.S. that they miss is if you're a member of ISIS or an Al-Qaeda affiliate and you're from Syria and Iraq, it could just be about survival, and that's the best offer you're getting at the day. But for foreign fighters, the attraction is very different. Many, it's very ideological. They're in pursuit of that. For others, it's adventure. You'll see groups of guys sort of travel together from Europe, and it's almost like their vision quest, right, that they're going to undertake. And the biggest part of all of it is ego. If they couldn't talk about how great they were on the battlefield, if there were no martyrdom videos, then who would want to be a suicide bomber? It's about ego and getting your story out there and being part of something bigger. So I think it's a combination of three. Some lean one direction or the other. For Omar, it always seemed more about his ego as much as his ideology in many ways.
And social media works so well that way, doesn't it? Feeding people's ego.
Yeah. The ones that you see pop up on social media in such a dramatic way like that are usually fed by the narcissism of watching themselves or seeing their exposure or growing their brand. I think that was somewhat true for bin Laden, by the way. I mean, he was worried about dyeing his hair because he wanted to look good on TV and look strong. Sure, that's a little bit about powering the ideology, but it's also a lot about him, you know, broadcasting his image around the world.
In fact, it's almost generational. You seem to say that Al-Qaeda and maybe even bin Laden himself didn't exactly understand social media, whereas ISIS, which is obviously a newer, probably younger group, seemed to understand the levers of social media.
Yeah, I don't see the Al-Qaeda-ISIS split as much about ideology as much as generations.
Right. And how they use the internet?
And how they use and communicate, how they network, and where their physical connections were. Part of bin Laden Zawahiri's problem was the second round of foreign fighters in Iraq and Afghanistan in the 2000s, they didn't really have a physical connection to them. The first ones they did, they built the training camps, they indoctrinated those, they selected them out. But that didn't happen once Zarqawi came along in Iraq. He was dynamic. He was a man of action. He wasn't sitting on a blanket talking about scripture.
Right.
He was saying, come join me. We are going to kill people. Here is footage of that. And that YouTube generation in the 2000s really is what powered ISIS going forward. They wanted to go after a caliphate. Once bin Laden was dead, there was no one holding them back from this. They understood social media as a recruitment tool. And if you watch their content, they switch to what looks like video game commercials and Army of One style action clips. They were focused on violence and you come and do this and you be like me. This is what the journey will be like. They were engaging people in a one-to-one way and doing it very successfully.
You're right. Omar and I weren't friends because he was a terrorist, but you did have a relationship. And I guess the difference between if you had met him on the battlefield, what you would have done versus having this conversation with him over time.
Sure. I mean, it would be go to guns, you know, combat, I'm sure, in a one-to-one way like that. And I was always hopeful that he actually would be arrested or, you know, brought into the court system, because I saw him as a great opportunity to communicate to the rest of the world, like, this isn't the best journey you could pursue. Mm-hmm. And those are the most effective people at communicating to future recruits. This isn't necessarily the way mm-hmm. you wanted to go. It was interesting that he was not only reaching out to me, he would reach out to Islamic scholars, and he would reach out to counterterrorism academics, you know, and he would try and build these conversations. But he was yearning for a connection because he didn't really have mm-hmm. one. He was in a far-off land with people that he wasn't originally from, and he was hunted by a terrorist group. And he even live-tweeted one of his assassination attempts. You know,
wow.
he was shot in the neck, and he took pictures of it and posted it on Twitter. He talked all the way up till he was killed, you know, and it was interesting. He would engage with reporters and provide firsthand accounts. And I thought that was valuable to really keep future terrorists from being recruited.
You mentioned the fact that having this rapport is a kind of a fairy tale. I mean, what are the options then in dealing with a terrorist? I mean, he was killed by his own people, in a sense, Omar.
Right.
But is it a matter of shutting them out of social media, or is it a matter of killing them?
Yeah. So it's fascinating. We tried all these countering violent extremism efforts, you know, going back the last decade, and I can't say that any of them worked. If I did, how could we say there's so many people in ISIS today? Ultimately, when the media battalions of the Islamic State were destroyed or reduced, that's when their propaganda slowed down. Uh-huh. And when the Islamic State wasn't successful on the battlefield, their appeal wasn't that great online, much like Al-Qaeda's. And so moving forward, I think it's important to remember if the physical world advances in a way that's negative, then the virtual world will follow and amplify that. And there's
the
a
physical leading the way.
Yeah, there's a symbiotic relationship for terrorist groups. If you're winning, then you can propagate winning. Mm. And if you're losing, it's pretty hard to sell the story once you see lots of foreign fighters slaughtered on the battlefield.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Clint Watts, our guest on Radio Times today. And he's got a new book. It's called Messing with the Enemy, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. He's a West Point graduate, former Army officer, former counterterrorism agent for the FBI. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me talk a bit about your experiences in the FBI. And you do talk about being a cadet. I guess, is that the right word?
Yes.
Sorry about that. And doing prank phone calls and, pranking people. How did that lead to what you ended up doing as an adult professional person?
Yeah. My time at West Point was the end of the analog era. It's surprising now, but we weren't allowed to have a radio even the first semester when we were there.
You were not allowed a radio.
Yeah. So as cadets, you sit in a room and you just talk to each other. And the way you burn time and get through the days is through practical jokes on each other. You know, that's how the world works. And you get a radio the second semester. You don't have a television. You can't really watch that till your third and fourth year when I was a cadet. There was no internet. And so if you got a hold of a phone was like not only your window to the world, you couldn't really call out, but you could call in. It was your way to entertain or sort of be a subversive and insurgent,
sure,
you know, against the administration. And so I would, you know, sit with some buddies. One of my roommates was really good with telecommunications, knew how to wire a phone. And so we had a party line, basically. We'd piggyback on one of the other lines, and we would make prank phone calls. And we had nothing else to do. I literally would take a cadet phone book and just call the different, you know, agencies around the academy, and it was just fun.
What would you say?
It was stupid, childish sort of stuff in the beginning.
Is your refrigerator running?
Yeah, you know,
like
what about this? What about that? What are you doing? And we would prank each other. That was
right.
A big, you know, fun. But over time, it started to be like, well, what could we actually do? And so the challenge became what ultimately I learned to be a behavior change. The goal and influence, whether you're Russian propagandist or terrorist like ISIS, is to create a behavior change in the audience. Either they migrate to Syria and Iraq, mm-hmm. or they show up at a cheesecake factory in Florida dressed as Hillary Clinton and climb into a cage as part of a propaganda. So we were doing the same thing. And I walked down the hallway and I saw an organizational chart. And I was like, oh, I've seen that phone number before. And I just wrote down all the people. And I was like, I will impersonate one of the other people in the organizational chart to sort of dupe the leader. And this went on for years, actually. And it got to the point where at the end, I would call this guy. I would prank him all the time. And he actually recognized my voice. I called him years later when I was in the Army. And he immediately said, Why are you still calling me? Like, what are you doing? I was like, oh, I'm in the Army. And we had almost like a friend relationship. We never really knew each other. But it was interesting that if you could have more data, if you could think about what would cause a physical reaction, you could start to move people and influence their behavior. And that's really where I started to learn it. Whatever it was, the snowplow operator, whoever it was, I would create scenarios that they would maybe go for. That is the backbone of cyber attacks. If you're a hacker, you know, spear phishing, everything online, or an influence, how you create scenarios that people want to move to support one political candidate over another or react in fear to a dangerous situation.
So does it take being a troll to understand how trolls work?
Yeah, it's easier to talk to a terrorist if you're a little bit of a terrorist in some way, right?
And
so, you know, I'm not proud of it. It was one of those things you look back when you're older and you're like, why was I doing that? At the time, it was great entertainment. We thought it was wildly fun in an analog world where we had the New York Times and a telephone. That was about it.
Yeah.
And so it was a great learning experience, though. I feel like when I was learning about, back then it was Soviet espionage, I was there at the end of the Cold War, it matched up very well with what I was reading about in terms of the East Germans and, you know, how they use information, how they do espionage, and how the Soviets are trying to perfect what was then called active measures, what we see today in cyberspace. And that was instructive. I kind of knew at a very bare bones sort of way how to understand what they were trying to do.
We're almost up on a break here. Was that a light bulb moment for you to say, oh, what I'm doing is kind of like what the Russians are doing? Or
no,
what?
I didn't realize until I was at the FBI.
Really?
When you're doing your counterintelligence training and you're seeing how they do espionage in the United States, the TV show The Americans, that's the analog version, you know, of counterintelligence. Then it sort of dawned on me. I was like, oh, this is just like prank phone calls.
Yeah.
You know, maybe that wasn't such a waste of time.
Well, let's take a short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Clint Watts about his new book. It's called Messing with the Enemy. And much more to talk about after this very short break. And we'll be talking more about Russia and the 2016 election and talk a bit about his own life as well. So do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Clint Watts, counterterrorism expert. He was among the first to publicly sound the alarm about Russia's efforts to disrupt the 2016 presidential election. He believes Russia's methods represent not an information war, but rather a war on information itself. And we've been talking about cyber criminals and social media, fake news, bots and trolls. And again, he's got a new book called Messing with the Enemy. And you can join us at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So what was the indication, your first indication that Russia was messing with the 2016 election?
It would have been in 2015, mostly because they went from talking, the accounts that I'd been watching with some colleagues went from talking about really foreign policy issues to American social issues, which seemed odd. And so one of the tells of a Russian disinfo effort is once you win an audience, you don't want to let it go. So with social media, this is super important. If you get a few hundred or 1,000 followers, then later you're like, man, I don't really want to let this go. I just want to move that audience over here and gain more audience and talk about different issues. And that's kind of a tell. They'll drift from topic to topic. Generally, authentic accounts will do that. They have things that they know about or are interested in. They'll kind of stay in it. So 15 was social issues, but it was also particularly a Sputnik News article I saw, which was, is Donald Trump the man to mend fences with Russia or something to that effect? And that was, I think, the end of August of 2015. And I thought it was odd because at that time, Donald Trump was kind of seen as this reality.
He just announced.
It seemed as a reality star. It didn't seem very serious. And it was fun watching him in debates, you know, because he was jabbing in a way no one had ever seen before. But it just wasn't serious, and it was interesting that that article would pop up and sort of be shared around in the system.
There was also a Alaska Back to Russia petition. I mean, there were several other things that on the face of it seemed kind of like, who would believe that, or how strange is that? But, and yet somehow that resonated with some people.
It always resonates with somebody.
It always, you know, and that's always going to be somebody.
That's always the counter I hear is like, oh, this didn't matter. It didn't make sense. And I'm like, sure, any one effort, when you look at it, looks silly sometimes or doesn't appeal to you, but it may have appealed to somebody else. The Russian disinfo system, too, will try everything. So unlike the U.S., where we will be like designing a campaign, like an ad campaign or a promotional, a PR thing, they don't do that. They sort of shoot in all audiences out messages, and they see what resonates. If it doesn't resonate, they'll just let it go. Right. It'll just die. But then if it is successful, they'll turn all their efforts to where they're finding success. And so on both the right and left side of the political spectrum, they found successes in certain places, and they just continued to bury it then from 15 into 16.
Did they invent the Pizzagate thing?
No, I don't think they invented it. I don't actually know who invented Pizzagate. But what tends to happen is you just see this amplification in the system. So a great example, you know, since the election has been the Nunes memo.
Right.
And so you will see
The Nunes memo about the Mueller investigation.
About the Mueller investigation. They love this because the ultimate goal of Russia, Russian subversion is not to win an election. It's to completely destroy democracy and erode it. And you do that by breaking citizen trust and confidence in elected officials and institutions. That right there is an elected official eroding an institution. He's in combat, essentially, information combat with an institution. That is a home run for any foreign influence effort because they can just take that, push it in and say, you shouldn't believe in democracy. Election is rigged. Voter fraud. All of these things. Don't trust it. Don't even participate. Just walk away. It's a terrible system.
So which do you think, maybe an unfair question, had a bigger influence on the 2016 election, the Russian meddling that you've been talking about, or James Comey's, well, actually two press conferences, one of them in July about Hillary's emails. He criticizes her for 15 minutes and then ends by saying that she didn't break the law. And then, of course, I believe it was in October where he talked about her emails being found on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Which do you think had a bigger influence on voters? Or is there any way to know?
I don't think there's any way to know. My estimate is that Russian influence kept the election close when it otherwise might have broken into a wide chasm between the two candidates. I think the Comey letter is what ultimately nudged it right over the top. And so I don't know how you would ever separate the two. If I had to point to case studies, I always tell people to look at Wisconsin and Michigan. And there's a few reasons why I think those are important. Extremely close races.
Right.
Typical Democrat strongholds. Places where Bernie Sanders outperformed Hillary Clinton in the primaries. And so if you look at the themes that were layered, there were basically six of them. First one was anti-Clinton. Second one was pro-Trump. The third one was Bernie Sanders got a raw deal from the DNC. Maybe he shouldn't even show up. That narrative was entirely created by the Russians. So if you've ever heard that repeated, that was created by a Russian hacking effort. The fourth one is you got to show up for Jill Stein. You know, even if she's not in the running, show up. And then five and six were about eroding democracy, which was election rigged voter fraud. And that was about, okay, if Clinton does win, I am going to prepare for how do I still keep this attack going post-election by eroding her base of support and her legitimacy as a victor. And I think they were in many ways just as surprised as we were about the outcome on election night.
I mean, all those things have to work in concert in a way.
Yeah, and they don't resonate equally everywhere. I just think those are two interesting case studies. We'll never know, by the way, because there's not good polling going into the election. What would you compare it against to?
Exactly.
I mean, every pollster, I think, across the board missed either in one month or the other, and then at the end were wildly off. So you really can't compare it to anything, which makes it very difficult to parse out. Does the letter matter more than Russian info, or what about political campaign? And it's very hard to tell.
I'm looking at a headline. This was October 31st, 2016, New York Times. So just a week or so before the election, investigating Donald Trump, FBI sees no clear link to Russia. You and your co-authors wrote something on War on the Rocks, trolling for Trump, how Russia is trying to destroy our democracy. These headlines completely contradict each other.
Yeah, it's fascinating because the Comey letter was the trigger. For me, in terms of we knew, or at least I knew, and you know, I talked to my colleagues. We have to put this out before the election, or it will look like it's part of a partisan, you know, charade based on the outcome of the election. And so when I saw it was that close, I kind of was believing that Trump could win, and I also believed that there would be no research into Russian disinformation post-election. And that is proven to be true. I haven't seen, you know, the U.S. government respond in the way they did to, like, terrorism and other things.
Let me quote you again. And again, this is from the New York Times. I guess it was an op-ed that you wrote April 3rd, 2018. You wrote, typically, the Kremlin deploys layers of surrogates and proxies offering business inducements, information, or threatened reprisals that can individually be explained away by coincidence while masking the strings and guiding hands of the Kremlin's puppet masters and their objectives. You go on to write, in Trump and his campaign, Mr. Putin spotted a golden opportunity, an easily ingratiated celebrity motivated by fame and fortune, a foreign policy novice surrounded by unscreened opportunists, open to manipulation and unaware of Russia's long run game of subversion. So you're saying the target has been the people around the president or the, the candidate, not the candidate himself?
Yeah. I'd written even right after the election, I never believed this Manchurian candidate sort of scenario. That's highly dangerous if you're Russia because that can provoke a war. Same with changing votes, you know, in voting machines. These are provocations that can lead to literal all-out war. But what they've always done very well is they look for the long run. They don't sit and wait and say, okay, now I'm going to go at the election. They say, let's build as many connections we can financially through oligarchs or through associates into the business sector. Let's work with parties. Let's engage with them, maybe the NRA or a Christian Orthodox Church, and build connections, legitimate connections with these organizations. And then the third layer is the people. You know, it's beyond state and party. They engage with people directly on a one-to-one basis, and they look for two kinds of people. One is called the useful idiot. That's literally a term from Soviet, you know, sort of espionage, which is, who are the people that unwittingly will move our cause forward? They're usually ingratiated by money or ego. And this kind of goes to the Omar stuff, ironically, in the book. But then fellow travelers, which are ideologically people who do agree with us and think like us, and we can partner with them and advance our agenda.
Would a useful idiot be Carter Page?
He might be, you know, a fellow traveler. I think, you know, he has common interest. If you listen to what he says, I don't think he's being disingenuous. He says, you know, we should align. We have a lot of commonalities. He got on stage in Moscow, I think it was July of 16, and basically gave his speech, said the U.S. has been too hard, you know, on Russia and some of its policies. And so I don't think he is unaware entirely, you know, of what's going on, but also is sympathetic to an alliance or building those connections.
How about Papadopoulos?
Papadopoulos, I think, is one of those scenarios where it's a young person who's quickly in a campaign, and there's all sorts of very smart, manipulative hands around him, and he doesn't know. And so I put him in the unwitting category in many ways of he's trying to do a good job and be a good campaign member, and he's sort of just involved in something he doesn't entirely understand.
President Trump is reportedly or apparently going to meet with Vladimir Putin in July or sometime this summer. What do you anticipate from that?
I'm sure it will be the best meeting ever, the greatest, and everybody will say that, right? But I think it will be very similar to what we just saw with Kim Jong-un, where it's two people coming together, and it's going to be very prepared, and it's going to be a success before you even get to the event. And my fear is that in each of these engagements, I feel like President Trump wants contact with Vladimir Putin more than Vladimir Putin needs contact with Trump. And he will open the door graciously to an authoritarian that just struck at our election. And I believe in a one-to-one, Donald Trump thinks he's smarter than the other guy in the room. And I think that's exactly what Vladimir Putin wants. He's a master. I mean, he's a KGB officer trained, and everything he does, he does very well. He's extremely smart, quite crude, and he will be all for leaving that meeting, letting President Trump believe he got a victory of some sort. But the truth is really in the pudding, I think.
Let me ask you something very personal. And I always read dedications to book and to books, and you dedicate this book to Pepper, your daughter. And I wasn't sure who Pepper was, and I got to near the end of the book where you talk about the fact that she has autism, or she, I guess she's on the autism spectrum.
Yes.
Why did you dedicate it to her, and what do you want us to understand?
Yeah, part of the reason I was on social media, even at all weird hours of the night, is with her autism, she has trouble sleeping. So if Omar's in Somalia and awake, I'm awake in the United States. And so part of the reason I could kind of pick up on these things or engage was social media was there for me when I couldn't achieve real engagement with my own daughter in a strange way. She's nonverbal. Great-spirited kid. And when I look at kind of how the world is going, this hyper-connected world, I am somewhat amazed how she's grown up that she won't really have to enter this.
Yeah.
More because of, you know, how autism has afflicted her, but maybe it's a gift. You know, maybe she is actually getting to live life in a more pure and real way than the virtual world around her. And so sometimes I feel relieved that she won't really be in that space.
But you also talk about the fact that you, in a sense, fell for this notion of the vaccines were going to lead to her autism or
yes.
lead to your baby's or your infant, your baby-to-be's autism, and something you had – it was a hard lesson, I guess, to learn.
Yeah, sure. I had talked to friends. They were worried about vaccines at the time. This is like 2008 time frame. And that was a conspiracy that was going around that if you give your kids too many vaccines, they will get autism. And so I started checking it out on my own. You know, Google leads to all sorts of interesting research. Mm-hmm. I talked to other friends that were doing this, which was not avoiding shots, but separating them out so they don't get too many at once. And I was very rigid about it. I talked to the doctors every time. And still, she got autism. You know, she has autism and probably had it from birth. And the way it was countered, and this is the importance of expertise. You know, I talk in the book, The Death of Expertise, is the first thing a doctor told me at Boston Children's Hospital, he's top autism researcher in the world, was you need to make sure that your daughter gets her shots. And I was okay. It was a rebuttal. I immediately dismissed the idea. But if I look back, I had confirmation bias. I wanted to make sure that I could control whether she got autism. I had implicit bias. I trusted a friend who also trusted somebody else. And so when you put all that together, it's what we see in social media today. It's very easy to go that direction.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Let me jump from that to something else you say in this book. America sucks at information warfare. Absolutely sucks. We have just a couple of minutes left. So what do you suggest that we do better?
Don't do information warfare influence at all if you're not going to do it all the way. For example, if you can't let a social media operator and counter influence operate the way the president does his personal Twitter account, then you're going to lose. And terrorists used to make fun of us, you know, when we would try and do this. They would literally be like, how long till you get fired? Shabab used to joke that way, you know, with U.S. operators. The other part is you got to know what you believe in before you go in and try and promote it. I don't think the United States knows what it believes in at this point. We believe in everything. We're a pluralistic democracy. We don't believe in just one thing. We believe everybody should be able to believe in whatever they want.
Right.
So if you look at who jabs and wins against us, authoritarians, Putin, terrorists and extremists, they know exactly what they're communicating. They know exactly what they want. And it's very hard for us to push back on them and say, well, everyone should be able to believe whatever they want. This isn't a powerful narrative to advance. We win in the influence space when we are great, when people want to be like us, when they listen to our music and they copy our values and they watch our movies, because that is the pluralism of ideas. That's what we've advanced around the world. And I think we've lost sight of that today.
So is it our movies and our music will do more than drones?
Yeah. When we're the best version of Americans, we don't have to tell or promote our brand and push it around the world. Our brand will be pushed around the world by people who want to be like us. And we've lost sight of that because I don't think people around the world want to be American anymore. I think they're starting to look for other alternatives.
We're going to end on that note. Clint Watts, thank you for coming in. Thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
You're welcome. Messing with the Enemy is the title of his new book, and it's subtitled, I should say, Surviving in a Social Media World of Hackers, Terrorists, Russians, and Fake News. And he is a Robert A. Fox Fellow in the Foreign Policy Research Institute's program on the Middle East, and the FPRI is here in Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Also, sign up for our newsletter. Adam Stanishevsky, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.